D-Mace, Vingen, and Donick, 102.5. The Game, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingen, birthday boy David Janes here with you. The big news in Titans land last night. Chad Brinker steps down as president of football operations. To help us discuss that more, we go to our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and welcome in our friend from the Tennessean, Nick Suss. Hi, Nick. How are you?
I'm here. How are you guys?
We are here as well. We are also doing well. Thank you for joining us. So, Nick, we have to start. You had an extensive report on Chad Brinker stepping down as president of football operations, and I seized on one graph in your lengthy story, and we need you to help us clarify exactly what you meant. You wrote, quote, "The source said many of the front office shakeups felt less like the collaborative associations they were billed as, and more like conflict management strategies to allow the organization's leaders to make the decisions they wanted without hurting feelings or directly alienating anyone." Can you please elaborate on that?
I mean, I can elaborate, but I think we can also just understand viscerally what these last 3 years have been. Like, if you look through it through the lens of what Chad Brinker's role has been since he got here, in a little more than 3 years, he went from guy who worked for the guy who hired him to guy who was above the guy who hired him to guy who was above the guy he hired to guy who was beneath the guy he hired. It has been
that about sums it up.
It has been a convoluted system that the Titans have been running the front office. And I think that there were people who, from the very beginning, sniffed out that this was not a sustainable business model. And I will give credit to the people who sniffed out that this business model was maybe not super sustainable. I will also say this. Chad Brinker comes from a scouting background. He alludes to that in his statement about his resignation. He essentially got pushed up the ladder into a role that did not allow him to do the things that he preferred to do. And it is my understanding that months of that led to his decision to move on from the Titans. We can re-legislate all of the strange conflict mitigation strategies of, okay, well, if we give this person this role, then they'll stick around even though we don't want them to do the thing that they used to be doing, and this and that. It's pretty consistent with what we saw 2 years ago when Brinker was promoted ahead of Rand, despite Rand retaining the GM title. It's pretty consistent with what we saw with months of talk about collaboration instead of one person having final say. It's pretty consistent with what the Titans have been really over these last 4 years of dissent on the field. There has been dissent with an I back behind the scenes of who's in charge and all of that stuff. And I'm not here for the palace intrigue. I am not trying to say this is the interesting thing. I think office politics are exceedingly boring, and it's frustrating that we can reduce a sport we all love watching because of the action and the drama to office politics. But look, to my understanding of the situation, this was not the healthiest working situation from Brinker's perspective, and he removed himself from it.
How should Chad Brinker's tenure be remembered, Nick? Because I believe the Titans were 12-39
in his
3 years with the team. He brought in Mike Borgonzi, so time will tell on that. But how would you define Brinker's tenure as a member of this front office?
I think the worst part about all of this is that we can't know. Like, there was something strange that happened in this era where the Titans made it impossible to know who was making what decision. And it's really difficult to say, okay, well, here's what he's credited for, here's what he's blamed for. I think broadly you can look at the mistakes made in the 2 years that Carthon was GM and understand that mistakes were made by everybody. I think you can look at last year's class where there was some crossover between the Carthon people who were retained, like Brinker, and the Borgonzi people who were brought in. And then you can kind of nibble and quibble on, okay, well, Brinker hired Borgonzi, and Brinker was the one who had the previous relationship with Reggie McKenzie. So what part of the office building belongs to that versus what part belongs to Borgonzi making the final say decisions on the draft, even though Brinker had veto power? And it's very convoluted, and it's hard to just pin down, oh, he deserves this blame, or, oh, he deserves this credit. I think if Borgonzi works out, it will always be an important footnote that Chad Brinker agreed to choose and chose Borgonzi over John Eric Sullivan, who he had that long professional relationship with, and obviously has since been deemed qualified enough to be the general manager of the Miami Dolphins. It's a tough choice to not pick your friend when your friend is qualified to go with a guy who you see as more qualified or more right for the franchise or whatever it might be. I do think that has to be part of the story, but you also can't totally exonerate the decision-making that led to some of the misses in those 23 and 24 cycles that kind of helped keep the Titans behind after those misses in 2021 and 22. And when you have five lost off seasons, that's a lot to recover from. And I think the most concrete thing we can say is while Brinker was employed, the Titans did not do enough to explicitly recover like they were tasked with doing.
We're talking with Nick Suss of the Tennessean. And Nick, you mentioned, and Adam brought up, how would Brinker's sort of tenure here be looked upon moving forward? And with that being said, how long, because we've had, you know, callers call in or text, and they're not confident that Amy is going to give the time allotted to help change this team or turn this team around. How long do you think realistically Borgonzi has now that Brinker's gone?
Unfortunately, there's only one person who can answer that question, and that person's probably not calling into DVD today. I don't
Fingers
know.
Crossed.
Hey, but we think she may have called in a few times. That's just us.
it might happen. I'm not ruling it out explicitly, but look, how
no,
much
based
time...
No, based upon what what this organization has went through over the last 5 or 6 years and what they've done as far as movement, how long would you estimate?
I would believe that the next year is still guaranteed. I don't necessarily think that we're going to be talking about any sort of hot seat in 2026, mostly because I do think there is some recognition that you can't do it off cycle again. You can't get away with a new GM and then a new coach, and then next time you make a decision, you're probably going to need to clean wholesale. I do think there is some understanding of that. I also don't think that they want to have a totally new direction heading into the new stadium year. I don't know if they want to have a totally new direction heading into the years you have to make the decision about Cam's contract long term. So I do, especially coming off of the goodwill that people have for Borgonzi right now, I do think that there will be time. But that all comes with the asterisk that none of us saw Rand being on the hot seat as quickly as he was. And with Callahan, it kind of came incredibly fast, even if some of us kind of expected it to come quickly. It came even quicker than it was expected. And it'll happen when it happens. And that's the part that's really difficult about following this team, about covering about this team, about talking about this team. One person's whims are going to decide everything. And I know that's true of any professional sports team with an owner, but it feels particularly whiplash inducing when this franchise is so prone to making those decisions the way they do.
Have you been, Nick, protecting yourself against that? Are you doing some extra neck exercises with your workouts and stuff to prevent whiplash?
If there is one thing you can guarantee about me, it is that I am not doing the things to take care of and protect myself. it's all for you guys. I am okay. an open sore for you guys.
Now, Nick, you wrote a an article this morning on the Tennessean about Carnell Tate and him being the number one and how Titans may see him. You got a chance to talk with the assistant general manager about him and about this offense, period. What are they, and the question was, how do you prioritize this offense or how are you envisioning this offense? What was his answer to that?
It was interesting because the first thing he said was the offseason priority was to go out and get weapons for Cam Ward in terms of wide receivers and tight ends. And then he said the second priority was offensive line and building up the trenches. And when I asked, well, was the receiver prioritized over that, said not necessarily. It just comes down to what was available to you at what times and what we were willing to do. So, I mean, whatever side of your mouth you want to believe, they did prioritize it. They went out and got Wandale Robinson and Carnell Tate, and they didn't get starting caliber players at those other positions. So whatever the plan was, the end result was going and getting receiver talent. And I've written this a couple of times. I do believe this. There was only one player the Titans could have gotten this entire offseason that would have been a projectable number one receiver past this year. Because you could have gone and gotten Mike Evans or Stephon Diggs or even DJ Moore and got somebody who you know is a number one, but the time is already expiring because of how long they've been in the league. You could have gone out and gotten Juwan Jennings or Romeo Dobbs or any of those guys who you kind of know were number twos and hoped they'd be a number one. You could have waited for Jordan Tyson or Mekhi Lemon, but those guys are not projected to be number ones in the way that Carnell Tate is. They went out and got the only guy who could have been a true future-leaning, future-focused number one. And again, I've said it before, I like the fact that now they can attack all three levels of the passing game with Carnell when you have your number one, number two, number three receivers on the field. If Wandale works the underneath, if Ridley can work kind of the run after catch in the intermediate, and Carnell Tate can kind of attack the deep third with some physicality and with some muscle at the point of attack, you've now opened up three levels of the offense, and I think that's what they were going after. Now you got to keep the quarterback upright for any of it to matter, but it does make sense if this was the priority.
Nick Suss is with us. He is the beat writer for the Titans for the Tennessean. Nick, you did a great job of laying out in simple terms this ebb and flow of Chad Brinker's role, but one thing that I can remember vividly is when they took steps to really roll out in their programming, right, from their website, their podcast, him chronicling the need for a new infrastructure with cohesiveness between scouting and analytics and all these other things that they were way behind in. Amy Adams Strunk, I think, gave him the green light to do that. Do you think as he walks away, the Titans have made progress? Have they caught up to other teams in these areas? Can he at least take credit for that?
That's a good question. I think back to a conversation I had with Chad. This must have been last August. And one of the things he said to me that really struck me was the goal of anybody in his chair is to build an organization that will be better without him than it was with him. And obviously he was talking from the perspective of somebody who wanted to do this for 25 years. He wasn't talking from the perspective of somebody who was looking forward to giving it up. But I do think when you think of Brinker from that perspective, whether you choose to believe that was sincere or just a thing you say to a reporter to sound like you're building forward future-minded, I do think that the Titans probably reflect the image that he saw them reflecting a little bit better than they did when he arrived. And maybe that's because we all understand the circumstances of when he arrived, where you had a head coach and a general manager who didn't seem to be aligned, and where you had an organization that was kind of fighting itself from the inside in so many ways with ownership, coaching staff, roster, and front office. I do think there is more alignment in the Titans coaching staff or within the Titans front office now. I do think that's the case. Whether you want to credit Brinker for that, whether you want to credit Borgonzi for that, or whether you want to credit addition by subtraction of all of the people that were making it a tougher environment by proxy of them not getting along with each other, those people aren't around as much. It's really tough to say, oh, this one guy did it. But I'll point back to something that Borgonzi said in his pre-draft press conference when asked about would he ever pick a player that the coach didn't like. And he just said, you have to have a foundation of trust with the people you work with, that you're not going to put them in a position to fail. And so it's not about I'm only going to draft people they like, but it is about I want to draft people that they think they can succeed with. And that kind of confidence is going to make it easier for them to do their jobs. And I think that perspective is emblematic of the changes that have happened over the last 2-3 years. But again, I find it hard to credit or blame one person for that proliferating.
Do you think others that are already in-house soak up Chad Brinker's day-to-day responsibilities, or do you think they will bring somebody in who doesn't quite have the head honcho title but will do essentially what he was doing?
I haven't been able to get a full answer on this, so I don't want to sidestep it, but I would not be surprised if the roles were absorbed. They have room to hire another person. Front offices love inventing titles that are all variations of the same four words. So they have a vice president of player personnel, right. And they have a director of scouting.
They have enough people.
Personnel. They have
they got a lot of people.
You can arrange these things around, but you can also invent a title, vice president of football strategic operation or something, and hire somebody to do that, because there's no shortage of adjectives when it comes to creating titles.
You've led me right into my final question, and that is the wild card of Bryce Wasserman, who we hear about. He's got a page on the website that says biography. It has his title, chief of staff, and then there's no other information at all on there. It's been like that for years. We know he's the son-in-law, etc. What do you think his role is, and is it going to be bigger after this news?
I'm not speaking out of turn when I say this. This is purely just observation. I spend a lot of time at events like the Senior Bowl, at events like the Combine, where you see brain trusts moving in concert together, where it's very rare that you just see, oh, that's Howie Roseman, but you see Howie Roseman and the Eagles brain trust, and they're moving as one. And this year at those events, when you saw the Titans brain trust moving, it was Mike Borgonzi, it was Chad Brinker, it was Dave Ziegler, if it was Reggie McKenzie, it was Dan Sagany, the vice president of player personnel, and it was Bryce Wasserman. He was already moving in the circle. I don't know how much more inner circle you can be than guy who was already moving in the circle and is also family with ownership. But if they elevate his role, we'll see. We'll see. It's hard to elevate his role without them actually explaining what the role is. So maybe the good news would be if he gets an elevation, there will be clarification on what he does.
Okay, so maybe a bio. Yeah. Maybe they'll actually put a bio.
Maybe this will force their hand to write at least like 10 to 20 words explaining his day-to-day responsibilities.
I just think it's the most, and it's been pointed out, there's several other people who have a title and a page on the website that have no bio, sometimes not even a picture. I don't get it. Like, hey, where are the IT people over there?
This is not a defense of it so much as it could be an explanation of it. The people who write those are the people who do all of the stuff for the team. So if they did not quite get to that, it is probably because they also have to write the bios of 30 friggin' undrafted free agents this week. Just a lot of new faces around this organization. Maybe it slipped through the cracks. I don't think it did, but maybe it slipped through the cracks.
Nick Suss of the Tennessean has been our guest on D. Mace, Vingan, and Donick. Of course, you can read all of his work at Tennessean.com. Nick, as always, a pleasure. We'll catch up soon.
Yes, we will. Thank you, guys.
615-737-1025. I feel like this Bryce Wasserman fella, he's becoming the new boogeyman I mentioned earlier that Chad Brinker was sort of this boogeyman for Titans fans. I think this Bryce Wasserman is taking that role of the—
It just screams of what's going on. The son-in-law, lawyer, not a football guy. So why is he in the brain trust? What's his role?
What did—
No bio. seriously.
Yes.
You're right.
This organization takes a lot of heat for not having it together from the top down, right? That's still, especially after this news, a major question mark. So now you've got this guy in there. I'm curious. He might be a really good guy. He might be a big asset. But how do we know?
Wes and Hermitage says, this bio thing is really bothering Willie. Yes, and I just can't stop laughing. Things that don't matter for 200, Alex.
You don't think it matters? Your chief of staff? No. There's not a single word written about him, and he's the son-in-law?
But this has bothered Willie for some months.
This isn't new.
It didn't just start.
Years.
Yes.
This isn't new. But what was it that Jack Black said in School of Rock? Little nepotiz? I think that's what we're talking about here. 615-737-1025. You can react to what Nick Suss had to say. Also coming up next, Albert Breer of Sports Illustrated shares some new details on why the Titans coveted Carnell Tate. We'll discuss that coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game.
Yeah, you know, I think at the end of the day, what you're looking for almost any time you're making a pick is you want to have a consensus as an organization on what the vision for the player is and how they fit, whether it be into your offense or into your defense, and what that looks like. And you want to have everybody have a good vision of what that is and feel comfortable with that vision is. And at the end of the day with Carnell, we just had a very good, I think there was that. There was a consensus vision on what he's going to do, where he's going to play, how he's going to fit in, and what he's going to bring to this team. So the fact that we were comfortable with that, I think led us to Carnell. And we're excited about what he does. You know, he's a receiver that can win at all three levels of the defense. You see him stretch the field. I think the unique thing about Carnell, too, is for a guy that's 6'2", he's a guy that can separate in a short area. He can run the majority of the route tree. And so what that means is you get a player that can also be productive on third down. But then you have this catch radius and the size and big hands where you see him show up in the red zone. And so that's what I think is unique about Carnell, is that a lot of times you get the bigger, taller, linear receivers. They're more like, I call them first and second down guys. They're not productive on third down because they don't have the route tree to do that. Or you have a bigger guy that doesn't consistently play big at the catch point. Carnell checked a lot of those boxes in that way, where we're feeling we're really getting a complete three down player that can contribute on these critical downs and these critical situations, third down in the red zone. And so for us, having that vision, seeing that consensus, he was a clear guy for us to take, and we were excited about it.
That was Titans assistant GM Dave Ziegler discussing Carnell Tate. And before we get to Tate, do we need to get to the latest in the Mike Vrabel, Diana Rossini saga? Because you guessed it, the New York Post has published another story. And it's not the juiciest story. I do think that this story has jumped the shark quite a bit.
Yes.
It's jumped multiple sharks.
The Post is milking it.
Multiple sharks. Inside Mike Vrabel's 24-hour emergency marriage summit with wife in Utah. After Diana Rossini photo scandal from the New York Post. And again, this is why this has jumped a shark. Quote, Mike and Jen Vrabel flew to Park City, Utah for an emergency 24-hour marriage summit just days after Page Six published exclusive pics of the former athlete cozying up to NFL reporter Diana Rossini at a bar back in 2020. See, the details in the story, again, this is why I think it's jumped the shark. Quote, we're told that the New England Patriots head coach and his wife enjoyed dinner at an upscale Park City hotel restaurant around 4 p.m. local time on Sunday, April 26th. Quote, they were cordial and talkative, but not overly flirty, a source exclusively told Page Six, noting that the couple talked, quote unquote, and ate for around an hour and a half. Quote, they seemed fine. It was a friendly, regular meal. Well, I'm glad they were able to talk during their meal. The elegant restaurant, located inside a 4-star Marriott-owned hotel, offers several gourmet entrees, ranging from a $123 porterhouse for two to a tomahawk ribeye for $165. It also offers signature appetizers such as seared ahi tuna, $24, to sizzling crab cakes, $32, and veal ossobuco, $21. Why we needed to know all that? No idea.
Filling out the story, it seems like. The story needed a little meat, literally, so they put all the meat items on the menu on the story.
Not much about the actual marriage summit. But
if they had a person in the summit, that's really not supposed. That's not counseling. Right?
Exactly. Not really inside the summit. Was the marriage counselor a plant for the New York Post? But yes, jeez. we've officially jumped the shark on this one, guys. There was footage today of Mike Vrabel at a season ticket holder event receiving a standing ovation from Patriots fans. That was a thing. I mean, yesterday we did analyze the alleged playlist between Diana Russini and someone named Mike.
That was just for fun, though.
I know. So we're part of the problem. Okay, we're part of the problem. But I saw that headline. I'm like, ooh, inside the marriage summit. Really glad that they went to a restaurant where they could get a $165 tomahawk steak and that they talked during dinner. I'm glad it wasn't just the silent treatment for an hour and a half. Anyway, back to Carnell Tate. You heard Dave Ziegler there. The question that spurred that answer was about choosing Carnell Tate over Arvell Reese. Like, they're both premium positions, both high-end players. Why did you land on Tate versus Reese? And that was Ziegler's explanation. Albert Breer of Sports Illustrated had some other reporting that I found interesting. Breer notes the decision really came down to two Ohio State Buckeyes who'd bring very different things to the table, receiver Carnell Tate and linebacker Arvell Reese. The jumping off point here is that the Titans had Tate in the mid 4.4s in the 40-yard dash at the combine, significantly ahead of the 4.53 that the electric clock got him at. The other thing I thought was interesting, and I want Derek's opinion on this. Albert Breer writes, quote, essentially, he has some traits of a smaller guy with the length and catch radius to make the bigger plays outside the numbers and down the field, which would help bring to life the arm talent that Cam Ward brings to the table. Also, where some people looked at the fact that Tate wasn't ever the number one at Ohio State, playing with Jeremiah Smith the past 2 years, Tennessee saw it as a positive, proof that a guy with traits of a number one can blend into a team. What's your thought about that last part, Derek?
It's hard to try to project, especially when you have arguably the best, when you're talking about the skill set, the presence and everything else, the best wide receiver in the country, regardless of draft year, playing alongside you. You could have put Jeremiah Smith at any university across the U.S. and he would have been the number one receiver, regardless of whoever else they had. So I don't take too much stock in that because, again, I watched Ohio State over the last 2 years, and they have a long history of wide receivers. We understand that, especially the last 5-6 years. But in watching Jeremiah Smith, it's like, okay, we know that dude has it. But as I'm watching the film, this other guy 2 years ago keep popping out the screen. Carnell Tate, another highly ranked wide receiver. He keeps popping out of the street. And not only that year, but the next following year, which was this year, this past season, he pops out of the screen. He's one of those guys you turn on the tape, you're like, man, who is that guy? If you didn't know, I'm like, man, this guy, I know they got Jeremiah Smith, but who is that guy? Because he possesses some of the same things that Jeremiah Smith possess. And look at all of these measurables that he has, whether it be big hands, the wingspan. And I talked about this with a guy that many are, he needs to get his completion rate. He need to be more accurate. What helps a quarterback become more accurate? One, an offensive line, I get that. And then two, working throughout the season, honing on some of those skills in the offseason. But when you have a receiver with a catch radius, a wingspan that Carnell Tate has that measures 78 inches, that is a bigger wingspan than Tet McMillan. And you see how much Tet McMillan helped out Bryce Young last year. His completion rate went up. They hope the same thing happens with adding a guy like Carnell Tate. it may not look – he didn't put up number one numbers in college because he had the best receiver in the country playing alongside him. But that what he was able to do does translate to what a number one receiver should be.
But, Willie, I want to go back to what Breer wrote there, that apparently the Titans thought, hey, this guy with clearly number one receiver skill, who is not the number one receiver on his team, was able to handle that role, blend into the team, not cause a stink, and we see that as a positive.
Right, as a team guy, basically. I understand that, and not a diva complaining, why aren't you throwing it to me more? And we made this point, Ohio State specifically wins most of their games easily, doesn't have to pass the ball a lot, so there's already less passes in the mix than a lot of teams. So that's another factor. I think you have to on that team be unselfish, right? Mm-hmm. Be patient to until your number is called. You may not get 10 targets or 11 targets. So that it can be a strength, but also I think we're going to have to see if he can end up being a guy that is worthy of that kind of thing. Like your number one receiver by definition should get a lot of targets each week. So I'm curious about that part. I'm also taken by the disputed 40 time.
Yeah.
How does that work? Like, you trust your guy more than you trust the electronic thing?
And those
like, how do you interpret that? Because I remember way back in the day running with the electric timer as opposed to the old guy with the stopwatch. I've seen both, and it's rarely synced up. But what's more accurate?
It's like anything. You're going to use whatever fits your narrative.
Right.
So
right. Whatever makes me look
exactly
faster,
whatever makes him look faster, that's what I'm going. Even though everybody goes by the official clock at the combine, everybody goes by it. But to make my conversation more valid, well, I had him at a 4.4. What did you have, Mo? I had him at a 4.5 flat. If there's some discrepancy from that, then I'm good. If everybody has him at a 4.53, then I was off. But if everybody has him 4.5, 4.49, and I got him at a 4.48, well, I'm in the ballpark. So he runs a 4.48. That fits my narrative, and that continues to push, you know, him as being a number one wide receiver. Carnell Tate, whether you believed he should be drafted, you know, at that fourth spot or not, this is what I do like about this kid. Is that, and I understand money is a factor, but he chose to stay at Ohio State. He chose to. That is huge. In a climate where people want to be the number one, they want to go leave, and I'm going to take my talent somewhere else. You're going to give me I'm sure that somebody offered him a little bit more money, but he said, you know what? I'm staying at Ohio State. I know I'm a number one. But I can hone in on my skills here with Heartline, and I can become even better if I stay another year at Ohio State rather than jumping ship going to another college to be undoubtedly the number one. That's one thing. He wants to fight. It doesn't matter to me. Bring it on. You say you're the number one, I'm going to continue to. That's what I like about him. He's about competition.
615-737-1025. We'll take your thoughts on Carnell Tate. We'll wrap up the show. Coming up next, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. Wrapping up the show today, a big thank you to Paul Kaharsky and Nick Suss for joining the program to talk about Chad Brinker stepping down as Titans president of football operations. If you missed those interviews, you can find them wherever you find your podcast. Let's go to our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com, and welcome in our friend Dr. Locke. Dr. Locke, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
What's up, fellas? What's up, D-Mace?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, I think I speak for a large percentage of Nashville when I say, what was Chad Brinker anyway? I'm ex-military, right? Before I got into my career in sales, I was military, and growing up in enlisting and going into service, there's a chain of command, right? You got a petty officer answers to a chief answers to a lieutenant, lieutenant answers to lieutenant commander, so on so forth. I think it was very confusing. Who answered to who? Was the president above the general manager? Was the general manager above the president? Who knows? Who cares? I think it's best with just one general manager. I mean, there was a lot of confusion wherein what was the chain of command. So, I mean, what was his job? Was he above a GM? Was he beside the GM?
What month are we talking?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So, you know what I mean? Where is the chain of command? Who answers to who? There was no succinct order. So I think now it's real easy. Now it's Amy, it's the GM, it's the coach. You know, I don't think we lost anything. I think we streamlined. I think that's a good word. We streamlined it.
Thank you, Dr. Thank Locke. You.
I mean, and that's how it worked best. I think when you go back to through their success, whether it be, you know, Jeff and Floyd, whether it be John Robinson and Mike Vrabel, there was there was a hierarchy there, and everybody had a role, and everybody know what that role is, what their role was, and it functioned better like that. When things started to get outside of that, I think that's where the organization started to have some problems, and it just the wheels fell off after they fired John Robinson. It just completely fell off, and hopefully now they've gotten everything back in order. I've always said that the minute they fired Vrabel, I think she wanted her organization back. She wanted everything back in order. And in her mind, and hopefully it's the case, she's gotten everything back in order, starting with hiring Borgonzi and now ending with the resignation of Brinker.
We do have an important update on a story I brought to you at the beginning of the show. When I had a hard time leaving my house this afternoon because of people illegally parked on my street because of an event at the record store Grimey's. My wife sent me a screenshot from earlier on the East Nashville Facebook page, which says, "Whatever is happening at Grimey's, just drove by. I saw many tow trucks towing. If you are in the surrounding neighborhood parked, it will be gone soon."
Do you think
doing the Lord's work?
Do you think you were a catalyst for this movement of tow trucks?
I think he was, because everybody's listening.
You didn't
to
call
us.
Anybody, right, Adam?
No, they're just
I did not call
to us.
Anybody. I did not call any tow companies.
Right. So, but others may have seen your angst and frustration with the situation. We got to do something. Get the tow trucks.
Maybe
out here.
We have a loyal listener who drives a tow truck,
or
and he said, and he said, or she said, they said, "Hey, some business." Some opportunities here.
Business is calling.
Maybe somebody who's listening to our show heard the beginning and your rant and putting these people on the hammer list.
Putting them on blast.
And made a post to East Side Facebook.
Maybe.
And action started to be taking place after that. The radio show could work in mysterious ways like that.
I really hope the car that was parked basically right on outside my driveway got towed. I really hope that car in particular.
Were there people, because this is one thing I do hate, and listen, my street isn't like yours where it's saying you can't park, but when you do park in front of somebody, don't park close to the mailbox. Just don't park close to the mailbox. That is my biggest pet peeve. When I look out my house, my front window, and I see someone park right up against my mailbox, like right there, and I'm thinking like, didn't y'all see that big mailbox sitting in front of that house right there, and you chose to park like it's the mailbox and then the front bumper of your car? Now my mailman, mail person can't deliver my mail? Just be considerate. That's all. And don't be parking on Adams Street either.
Damn right.
Grimey's, all right? Be considerate.
Now, Derek, I do want to ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes in the NBA, the first round is a bit chalky.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't many major upsets in the first round of the NBA playoffs. But your Pistons are on the brink, down 3-1 to the Orlando Magic. Game 5 in Orlando, I believe. No,
I think it's back in Detroit.
It's back in Detroit.
1 and 2 was in Detroit.
Yes, Game 5. Pistons down 3-1 to the Magic. Do they survive?
I'm hoping they do. The Magics are they're a tough team. And the Pistons, they just hadn't been playing. That persona that they had during the regular season isn't doing anything for them during the playoffs. Kay Cunningham, he has stepped up, but everybody else during those guys, they just hadn't been playing the way, and they hadn't been playing defense the way they need to be playing. Hence, they find themselves down 3-1 against Orlando. You're talking about a team that won 60 games this season in Detroit compared to a team that won 45 in Orlando, and now they up 3-1, beating you at your place, and now you get to go back to your place to hopefully extend it. This would be a big disappointment for the city of Detroit and Piston fans, because they were, you know, beside Boston and New York, and there are a couple, maybe one or two other teams, sort of the front runners to play in the NBA Finals. And right now, Pistons might even get out of the first round.
Take a wild guess. How many 8 seeds have beaten a 1 seed in NBA history?
8-1.
In a best of 7 or best
yeah,
of 5?
Yeah, because they've been changing.
Best of 3.
I guess. Exactly.
In a best of 5 or a best of 7.
Okay. 1-8, I would say. Can I put it in percentages? Or do I got to put it in wins and losses?
How many total 8 seeds have beaten a 1 seed in NBA history?
I would say, 15?
I'll say 10.
6.
Oh, wow. Well, Orlando may be number 7.
The 1994 Nuggets over the Sonics.
I remember that one.
The 1999 Knicks over the Heat.
Yes, I remember that one.
That was a weird year because that was a lockout. Yes. Yeah, that was a lockout year. That was a shortened season.
The 2007 Warriors over the Mavericks. The 2011 Grizzlies over the Spurs.
Yes.
The 2012 Sixers over the Bulls. And the 2023 Heat over the Bucks. That's it.
Heat and Bucks.
That's it.
Was that who was on that Heat team?
Would that have been Jimmy Butler?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Was that the Jimmy Butler Heat team? It may have been.
In 2023, yes.
Yeah, because they went to the conference final, didn't they?
I don't Eastern remember.
No. They made the NBA final.
Did they make the finals?
I think so.
Yeah. And they
against the Nuggets.
Yes, and they ended up losing.
But Willie, we talked so much about how 8 seeds, quote unquote, win in the Stanley Cup playoffs. It almost never happens in the NBA playoffs.
A lot less.
So if the Magic were to pull that one off, it would be quite remarkable. Josh from White House on the update on the tow truck. Oh, that warms my late 30s heart. Justice is served.
Everybody's pulling. They with you, Adam.
I mean, look.
People are with you.
I'm a little petty when it comes to certain things, so when I have a hard time getting out of my own driveway, driving up my own street, I hope that those cars get impounded, okay?
Man, there's nothing.
Who
I can
among
see
us?
I can see if there were there was construction on the street and there were trucks and stuff, and okay that. But if it's just because of grimies down the street that y'all parking on my block and it's illegal, I should be able to come out my house, casually get in my car, and back up or pull out. And just go without having all these cars in front of me. So you're right, Adam.
So remember this as you're going about the rest of your day, everybody. Do not knowingly illegally park, especially on a residential street, because that would make you, altogether now, a garbage person. That'll do it for
Adam will come after.
He will, best believe.
And he is backed by the Eastside Facebook page.
I have some sway on the East Nashville Facebook group. That'll do it for us today. We will be back tomorrow. Elliot Freeman of Sportsnet will join us. Maybe we'll have a surprise guest or two. Quite frankly, I haven't planned the show. So we'll find out. So far is Elliot Freeman will join us at 5, which is always a pleasure. But have a wonderful rest of your Wednesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 3.
Be loved, love all your people. Have a safe, blessed, and wonderful day. I love you. The team loves you. You hear that music, don't you forget about us, because we will not forget about you. See you tomorrow, 3 p.m. on 102.5 The Game, and stay off of Adam's block.
Yes.
All right. Peace.
Don't be a garbage person.